Support for The Full Story comes from Long Wharf Theater, creating theater of, for, and by the people of Greater New Haven. Everyone's story has a place at Long Wharf. You belong.
He spent 33 years in jail for murder. Now a judge has dropped all charges against him. Keith Bush is suing Suffolk, and authorities are looking at others who say they too were wrongly convicted for other crimes. Welcome to The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. In just a moment, we're going to get to our discussion about Keith Bush, but I want to tell you that a bit later on, we're going to be talking about New York State troopers and body cams and dash cams. They don't have them, and some are wondering, why not? So we're going to talk with some Connecticut troopers about how that's working out in the Nutmeg State. But first, we're going to start with the case of Keith Bush. For that, we want to welcome Tom Mayer to the program. Tom writes for Newsday, and you may also have seen him on News 12, and he's been covering this story from the beginning. Tom, welcome. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for inviting me, Ron. I appreciate it.
It's our pleasure. Tom, take us back to the beginning. What happened back in 1975?
Well, in 1975, Keith Bush was 17 years old. He was in high school, and he had attended a party with a number of other kids in Bellport. And at the end of the evening, there was a 14-year-old girl named Charisse Watson who was killed. A couple of days later, Bush was charged with her murder, and he was convicted, and he spent a total of 33 years in jail. What emerged, though, in the last year or so, is that there were documents that show that there was another suspect all along in the case, a fellow by the name of John W. Jones, Jr., and he actually gave a statement to police in which he said that he attended the same party, that he tripped over the dead girl's body in the nearby lot where her body was found, and that a comb that was next to her body was Jones's comb. And yet, despite that incriminating information, it was never brought up in – it was suppressed by both the prosecutor and the police. It was never brought up at Bush's trial. Neither the judge nor the jury ever learned about it. And it only came out recently through the efforts of Bush's attorneys who were pressing efforts to try to free him.
So Keith Bush was arrested. He was, I think you said, 17 at the time, right?
Correct. He was pulled out of high school.
He was convicted, but I also remember, I think it was from your reporting, that he signed a confession, didn't he?
Yes, he says he was. He had the confession beaten out of him over a number of hours that he was spent. He had no lawyer. His parents were not aware of the fact that he was being questioned by police, and the quote unquote confession was actually a written statement that was written out by the attorneys by the homicide detectives who took his statement, and he was asked to sign it. So there was no tape recording, no videotape, nothing like that. Bush says that it was beaten out of him.
And if I remember the reporting correctly, I believe that you and others have written that he was basically worried that they were going to kill him.
Well, that's certainly what he said. I mean, imagine if you're 17 years of age and you're suddenly accused of a murder that you didn't do. And, bear in mind, it's not uncommon for people who are accused of murder to say that, a confession was beaten out of them or things like that. Certainly not in Suffolk. That's not an uncommon thing historically. However, the district attorneys, the current district attorney, about a year and a half ago, set up a Conviction Integrity Bureau, and they extensively looked at the Bush case. And one of the things that they indicated was that Bush's statement, the so-called confession, was the result of essentially force by the detectives.
It was the police themselves, or I should say the authorities themselves, who determined this. They said the confession was beaten out of this young man.
Right. This was a report that was given to the judge who, on May 22nd of this year, exonerated Bush. And that exoneration took place 44 years, more than 44 years after the actual murder itself.
Keith Bush spent 33 years behind bars. Where was he during that time?
Well, he was in a number of different prisons all around New York State. In fact, he was eligible for parole by 1994, and he went before the parole board, and they said, "Well, you know, you've been a good inmate. You know, followed the rules and such. But before we let you go, we want you to admit some type of culpability." And Bush refused to admit any culpability because he has maintained from day one that he had nothing to do with this murder case. So six times over a 12-year period, he went before the parole board, and he said he wouldn't admit culpability, and he wound up staying an extra 12 years in prison because of that stand.
Have you spoken with him? What's he like today?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Bush is, at Newsday, we found out about this case from Bush's attorney. She called me. We did a series about 30 years ago about the Suffolk Homicide Squad and the prosecutors and some of the same problems, in fact, some of the same individuals in the Bush case. And so the attorney called me because we had written about this 30 years ago, and she actually cites it in her court papers to the district attorney. And, you know, so we got to speak to Bush very early on. And we've also been filming, as you alluded to, we've been filming interviews with Bush and everybody related to the case. And that was part of a two-part series for News 12 and also for a Newsday documentary that we have published, but we're in the process of updating that as well.
You mentioned another gentleman, another man who was there at the murder scene at the time, John Jones Jr. Is he still on Long Island?
Yeah. Right, yes. He's slightly older. He was about 21. Most of the kids, the victim was 14 years of age. What I found in my reporting is after Bush was convicted, Jones, whose name, again, was never brought up at all in Bush's trial, he went on to commit other crimes. And in fact, one of the more dramatic aspects of this whole investigation by us was we found that about 10 years after this murder, Jones was in a knife fight, and the authorities arrested him and wound up taking a blood sample. And it turned out that that blood sample was kept by the crime lab over 25 years. And there was some DNA that was found underneath the fingertips of the victim, Sharice Watson. So for about 3 or 4 months, this investigation centered on the fact that this blood sample from Jones might actually conclusively show that Jones was the killer. When Bush was exonerated in May, the authorities, the district attorney's office, indicated that Jones was the likely murderer of this girl. But they said that Bush was innocent and the judge exonerated him of all the charges.
Tom, I have about 2 minutes left in this segment. What is Mr. Bush's legal team asking for?
Well, generally speaking, these type of cases, it's about $1 million a year in damages that are usually either through a jury trial or, you know, or a settlement, usually a settlement. There's about a rule of thumb, about $1 million for every year of wrongful conviction imprisonment. That's usually the damages that are agreed upon. So Bush has, you know, a sizable lawsuit against Suffolk County because of this. He's not the only one, however. And in fact, the district attorney's office is now examining about 100 claims of innocence, and they're reviewing those cases, including one which I've reported about. It's a murder case that goes back to the 1990s. Now, there's been no determination that I know of yet on those claims, But there are other cases that are pending against the county. And so I know that the people that are concerned about the finances of Suffolk County have expressed concern about what the fallout may be here fiscally for taxpayers as well.
Governor Cuomo involved with this?
Yeah, we found out last week, we reported that Governor Cuomo's office is reviewing the Bush murder case, which is one of the longest innocent man prosecutions in U.S. history. And part of it has to do with that the Bush case is a really good example of what Cuomo has been talking about in trying to create a prosecutorial conduct review board that it right now is being opposed by the state district attorneys. There's a lawsuit up in Albany, but it has been created. The actual commission has been created, and it would seem that the Bush case is a really good example of the concerns about prosecutorial misconduct, because in this case, the prosecutor knew within about 3 or 4 months about this other suspect, and he violated both the law and legal standards, ethical standards, by never mentioning to the jury or to the judge that there was another suspect.
Tom, with the 30 seconds I have left, I know that they are suing in Suffolk. Is there also going to be a federal lawsuit?
Yes. Usually the state lawsuits, they have a formula in which people who have been innocent, found innocent either through DNA or for other means, they're able to be compensated a little bit quicker than in the federal system. Usually the federal system is a broader investigation. It usually has to do with the violations of civil liberties and civil rights, and they tend to be more involved, but and they also take a lot longer.
Tom,
so I think...
Tom, I'm sorry, I'm out of time. I appreciate it. Great reporting. Thanks for your time today.
Great, Ron. Thanks for the invite. I appreciate it.
Tom Mayer, Newsday. It's the full story on WSHU. It's the full story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. If you'd like to join in today's conversation, you can find us on Facebook. Our Facebook page is Full Story WSHU. And you can leave a comment there, or if you don't use Facebook, you can drop us an email, TFS, the full story, TFS, at WSHU.org. And remember, our program airs twice. You could hear it at 1 o'clock and then at 7 o'clock, and you could always stream it at WSHU.org. We're going to bring in J.D. Allen now from our studios on Long Island, because we're going to talk a little bit about New York and policing and recruiting. And J.D., how are you today?
I'm good, Ron. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. We do have two Connecticut State Troopers in the studio with us, and they're going to be joining us in a few minutes to talk about recruitment in Connecticut, but also about body cams and dash cams, and we'll have a nice conversation about that. But you're doing something a little bit more specific, JD.
Yeah, well, we're taking a look at New York and New York State Police. They're one of a few states where the main law enforcement agency for the state does not have body cameras or dashboard cameras yet. And this is after a big national push a couple of years ago that got a lot of states interested and got funding for these types of projects. But New York State, with the largest state police force still without these body cameras, there's no momentum really in New York for these cameras.
So it begs the question, what is taking so long in New York State compared to other states?
Well, it's interesting, actually. So some of the municipalities in the state are very interested in body cameras. For instance, New York City Police finished a rollout of about 20,000 body cameras this year. Suffolk County Police were given money to purchase cameras for their DWI teams last year. But as far as the statewide police force goes, it had used like VCR tape cameras back in the 90s. Those kind of wore themselves out. They updated some of them with digital cameras, but the maintenance was just the maintenance and training that went into keeping this program running. It just ceased once funding got tight.
You know that there are some younger members of our audience who are saying, VCR, what the heck is that? Say ancient technology. But the new cameras, if you look at them, they're really amazing. If anyone has ever used a GoPro camera or something like that to do action footage, to put it on a ski helmet, to put it on bike riding, whatever, it's basically that, which sits on the front
of a deck of cards.
It's the size of a deck of cards. Very small, and it could what? It could operate pretty much all day.
Yeah, and they both take in audio and visual, which is incredibly important for multiple reasons. Law enforcement experts credit these patrol cameras as a great way to increase transparency and hold officers and citizens accountable. So I should mention that there are two New York State lawmakers who have put legislation forward this year to try to get the ball rolling once again. That's Senator Kevin Parker and Assemblywoman Latrice Walker, both of Brooklyn. And they really say that their drive behind this is to clear officers of wrongdoing, but also to uncover misconduct as it happens.
So if that goes forward in the next legislative session, still no cameras would probably be available for what, a year or two?
Probably, and it's very expensive to keep these things going. The state police union is actually behind the body cameras, but they estimate that it'll cost about $3,000 per unit every year, and that comes out to about $15 million a year for training, maintenance, and to handle Freedom of Information law requests as the public tries to inquire about the footage that they're interested in.
WSHU's J.D. Allen. Thanks, J.D.
Absolutely, Ron.
Let's get the perspective from Connecticut now. I want to welcome back to the microphone Connecticut Trooper Tyler Wearden, who's a member of the State Police Governor's Security Unit. The trooper was with us, a month or two ago?
Right around there, yep.
Welcome back. It's
Thanks
good to see
me.
You. And you may recognize your voice from her many, many appearances on television, Trooper First Class Kelly Grant. I'm sorry, I don't mean to embarrass you. How are you? Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Trooper Wearden, how long has Connecticut had body cams now?
We rolled out our program in October of 2018, so we're just over a year. We purchased 800 of them with federal assistance through a grant that DOJ was offering. We have about 650 in the field right now, and as we train new troopers that come out of the academy and build a little more infrastructure in the back end as far as storage goes, we'll roll out the rest of those 800.
How many troopers are there in Connecticut?
We're right around 900.
Okay, so it's just a little short. I'm just trying to do the quick math.
Yep, and our priority is to get them out to the troopers that work patrol. So even though it's only 650, you have to account for everyone that works in plainclothes assignments or specialized units. Our priority is to get everyone in a patrol function mm-hmm. with a body cam and a cruiser cam.
Trooper Grant, where do they attach when someone sees an officer, sees a trooper, and they're saying, well, maybe he or she has a body cam? Where exactly is the body cam?
So it is attached to the, well, in this case, it's wintertime, so we are wearing ties. So it'll be attached to the tie just around in the center of the chest. You'll see a small square box.
And what JD was saying there, and he said like a size of a pack, a deck of cards. I've seen ones a little bit even smaller, right?
Right. Depending on the department, depending on the agency, I'm sure, you know, the cost plays a factor. The union's going to play a factor of the placement of them, what type you're going to get, because you have seen the ones, I'm sure, that sit on the officer's shoulders, just mm-hmm. a little tube. But in our case, we went with the smaller box that goes on the chest.
How do they turn on? How do they turn on and off? Does the trooper do it? Does it happen? I mean, it's not on 24 hours, right? It's you got to turn it on and off.
Right, just with the push of a button. And before rolling out the body cams in the field, we wrote a policy and trained the troopers on when to activate it. Basically, any interaction with the public, so whether it's a traffic stop or you're responding to a domestic violence call, that should be activated. There are exceptions, especially under FOIA and what we're releasing to the public. If a trooper's in a medical facility or they're watching someone get a psychological evaluation, we still need to protect people's privacy while also protecting the general public and the trooper.
When you say FOIA, that's Freedom of Information.
Yes, sir.
The privacy consideration is such... The magnitude of it nowadays, because it seems that everything that we do, everywhere we go, we get recorded. There's a camera someplace. And I can just imagine that in certain situations, if someone is being pulled over, they may say, I don't want this recorded. Do they have the right to do that, or does this happen automatically?
It is automatic, again, as Trooper Weirden was saying, when the troopers have an encounter with the public, those do come on. And again, it's to protect the integrity of the trooper, the integrity of the investigation, and that person that they're making contact with.
You have incredibly stressful jobs. If anybody knows anyone who is a friend, who is a trooper, who is a police officer, or family members, or what on, and you hear the stories, you understand what you go through. So my question is, in an incredibly tense situation, when a million thoughts are going through your head, isn't it simple to just forget to turn on the camera? I mean, I know it's only a push of a button, but in the meantime, you're thinking about a million other things, and in certain cases, how to stay alive, how to protect yourself.
Right, and we've worked that into the policy. It says over and over again, along with the training, that priority is the number one concern. At no time should they put themselves or other people in danger to activate that camera. And like we saw with the Danbury shooting, if you have a camera on your chest and you take off your seatbelt or you're running and chasing someone, there is a chance that that camera can fall off. We've seen that multiple times, and that's something that we're looking at as far as functionality and cost, with maybe looking at a different vendor for that camera.
There are some who say, well, it didn't record it this time. The troopers did that on purpose or whatever. But things happen, right?
Right. At the end of the day, everyone's going to be judged with reasonableness. Was it reasonable? Should they have thought in the middle of a shooting to activate their camera? Is it reasonable to think that someone under that amount of stress could forget to activate a new piece of equipment that they might have just done 15 years on the road and never had that? And now we've said, here's this new deck of cards, put it on your chest. Oh, and don't forget, mm-hmm. when you're chasing someone, activate it.
Right, exactly. Trooper Grant, I've read that the body cams are integrated with the dash cams. I don't know what that means.
Yes, I couldn't give you the technicality on it, but I can tell you that when one is activated, the other one is activated also. The information that you're seeing in the body cam is being sent to the computer in the car, and everything is recording.
So they're working in tandem, if you will.
Yep, absolutely. Yep.
So if the trooper is recording something or the camera is being used on the body cam, it's being transmitted to the computer in the officer's car, in the trooper's car, and then mm-hmm. that is being stored there?
Right. So then at the end of their shift, they can upload. The camera itself can hold 32 to 34 hours of video. So at the end of their shift, they'll upload it, and we keep everything on site. It's not a cloud-based storage yet, but it is on premises so that we can get those videos, give them to legal, have them redact them. It's a lot of work in the back end as far as releasing the videos and housing them, mm-hmm. but the MVR, the in-car camera, and the body cam do speak with each other. It's just another tool, another view. So when they're out of the view of their vehicle, we can still see what's going on in a residence or a business.
Trooper Grant, how do troopers feel about this? I mean, they've been around now, I know, for a while, but still, I'm know that the younger generation, let's put it this way, technology is nothing for
right,
them.
Exactly.
I mean, everything is recorded and
exactly.
everything is shared nowadays. Those who are just a wee bit older, and I may include myself in that class.
Well, I'm definitely included in that.
sometimes we'll say, you know what, I don't want all of this, or I'm not right. used to this technology. How is this meshing with the troopers?
Yes, absolutely. It's a learning curve. You know, people have a hard time adjusting to something new. You know, that's just how we are by nature. I can tell you when I first came on the job, there were not computers in your car. Mm-hmm. And I had to get used to having this computer in my car. And this is where I did my reports. And this is where information was sent to me. So everything is an adjustment. Everything is a learning curve. You're going to get to this point where whatever, it's there, and I don't even realize that it's there. I just know it's one of the tools that's on my belt. And, you know, we've gone through over time, we've added tools to our duty belt, our tool belt, that we've had to get used to. So this is just another one of those tools that we're adding.
Trooper Weirden, it's weird because the other day I was thinking of this show coming up, and I was walking and I passed by a trooper's car. It was on the post road. And I looked inside and I'm saying, oh my gosh, it's like NASA in there. I mean, it is
yeah.
just amazing, the
yeah.
technology that is in a cruiser.
Right. Mm-hmm. And just like with computers and tasers and everything else that we've gotten on our tool belt, I think the troopers and police officers around the country in general are going to warm up to this mm-hmm. a lot more as it goes on. I speak to Internal Affairs on Friday, and they said they had two recent cases where a motorist was stopped for speed, and they made a complaint about the trooper's attitude. They said they were racially profiled, and one person said the trooper damaged their vehicle. The MVR and the body-worn camera completely exonerated the trooper. Mm. It was unfounded because the entire thing was recorded. So as we see more complaints exonerated with fact, I think troopers will get on board even more.
Which is an interesting perspective, because I remember when this was first happening, when it came out, some troopers, some police officers had told me in private, they said, look, this is a way that they're trying to get us. And in the meantime, you're saying it's the opposite now.
And that's around the country. There are a lot of large departments who have reported less complaints, more exonerations, less use of force. We don't have the data as far as a long enough period to say that, but I do think we're going to see a benefit.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody know what the malfunction rate is? I mean, you were talking about it before, Trooper Weirden. I mean, you go out, you're chasing someone, you go for a run, but I mean, is it just it happens, and there are real no statistics on it?
I mean, I know you probably have taken your seatbelt off and it rips your tie clip off.
Oh, sure, yes.
The design of the unit is very important. Because we get a good field of view with that chest unit versus something on the glasses or the shoulder. But you have that seatbelt constantly coming on and off. And when you're jumping out of a car, it might get snagged. I don't know what the exact malfunction or fail rate is, but it's always going to exist, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And so just to clarify again, a trooper's main job in terms of using this body cam is simply there's a big on-off button. So if you're going out, if you pull someone over and you're planning to get out of your car, you just hit the on button and that's it? And then you just go about your normal duties?
Correct.
Okay. And that's recording video and audio. And so then when the trooper returns back to his or her car, they just turn it off again and then proceed for the rest of the day?
Yep. And if it's important, they can flag it in the system and that'll change the retention period. If it's not flagged as an arrest or use of force, we retain that for 90 days. But if it's related to a criminal investigation or someone makes a complaint or there was a use of force, there's a 4-year retention period or the length of the investigation.
It's just so I can understand, when you say 90 days, does it get uploaded automatically to the server that you were talking about? Or does that take place when the trooper finishes his or her shift?
Yes, when they go back to the troop, they can upload everything on their camera. They can charge it, they can upload it at the troop, kick it up to the main
okay.
server.
So like you were saying, it's not in the cloud nowadays or anything like this.
Right.
This has to be done automatically. Have there been any troopers, I don't even know if they could do this, have there been any troopers who say, this isn't for me. I don't enjoy. No,
I'm sure they've said it.
Yeah,
I don't
sure,
think
yeah.
anyone's
sure.
cared. It's
but,
not a choice.
But they don't
right.
have an option.
No.
This is something that you have to do.
Yes.
Okay. But
yes.
but you got to figure that there are some who are saying, I've got enough to worry about.
Well, yeah, I'm sure there are some that are saying that. But as Trooper Weirden said, quickly everybody is learning and seeing the benefits of having a body worn camera.
Have you noticed a difference in the attitudes for the troopers after they started wearing this, or is it pretty much just now? They've acclimated to it. It's not that big of a deal.
Correct. I mean, you have nothing to worry about if you act consistently.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't need to adjust their way of speaking. They don't need to adjust their attitude. They don't need to adjust their work style. You know, they continue to have integrity and continue to be ethical. So it's really not an issue for the majority.
I hope this doesn't come across as flippant, and it's not meant that way, but I was watching a little bit of football. It was Sunday, and so they had a bunch of cameras obviously showing the games, and I'm thinking of the New England game that I'm watching last night. And it's showing angles of plays from all over the stadium, 3 or 4 different angles. When you're wearing a body cam, it's only showing you that one angle. Can possibly the story gets somewhat distorted from just showing that one angle?
I would say absolutely. It's no different than the cruiser camera, the dash cam video. You're only seeing one angle. And let's say the trooper's facing someone and they turn their head, not their entire body. You're going to miss out on what they're seeing. However, it's better than not having it. Even if we can't capture the entire incident 360 degrees, we now have two cameras that are capturing it.
I see what you're saying. Trooper Whedon, just to wrap up the conversation on the dash cams and the body cams, there are a few questions I had as I was thinking about this last night. If, let's say I'm not involved in an incident, but let's say a family member is, and I know that this has been recorded. Do I, as a member of the public, because this is somewhat public information, isn't it? Do I have the right to ask for that video so I can view it?
Yeah, any member of the public can make a oral, written, or electronic preservation request to Legal Affairs. We treat it as any other request for information. It'll be a FOIA request, and it's first come, first served, so there is somewhat of a backlog, and Legal will go through the video, and they'll remove certain things, especially if it has to do with minors or it's a scene of a domestic or a suicide or a sexual assault. There are a lot of guidelines as far as what we can and can't release, but any member of the public can request video.
But it's not a guarantee that you will get, as you were saying, unedited video, or that you're going to get it within a certain period of time. There may be a waiting period. And
absolutely, there's going to be a waiting period. They can only redact so much so quickly, but they can request it. It probably won't be unedited. And especially if the case is still under investigation, they're not going to release any video related to it until that case has been adjudicated.
Has it come up with where some, because there are some who, and if I can put this in the most polite way, feel a certain way about the police force, whether it's a local police force or state police and so on. And I could see where some people would say, I want to see all the footage all the time, and they will be filing all the, has anything like that happened so far? I won't say nuisance lawsuits, but someone constantly asking for this.
I think Legal experiences that sometimes. I don't work up in Legal, so I'm not sure what they get for requests, but I think there are some people who overwhelm with certain requests, and some may be legitimate and some may be nuisance, but we treat it as any other request. They have a right for to get the information, whether it's a report or video, and we treat it just like anyone else.
There was an interesting report in the New York Times the other week, and I don't know if you saw this, but I found it fascinating. So China has had a crackdown for a number of years now with the number of their minorities. And basically what they're doing is they're using DNA now from these groups, and they're putting it into a database. And then also they're using facial recognition. So that way they could track people for the future, and they know where they are, and they know how to keep them in certain communities and to restrict their rights. And there are some who are worried because the cameras have evolved so quickly that some of these cameras can be equipped in the near future for facial recognition, which to me I found to be fascinating, because we know about it now for still cameras in cities and as people are walking around. And my question was, if these small cameras would soon have facial recognition technology built into them, so let's say when a trooper goes up to someone's car or wherever, and that way this will be sent, if it evolves quickly, into a cloud, and it'll be able to send back to the trooper saying, this person is wanted for this, or this person's facial recognition technology report matches this suspect. Have you heard anything about that? Is anything like, and is it of a concern to those who are worried about privacy?
I think it's a valid concern, but there are some countries and some agencies that are moving away from privacy. We are running towards it. We are doing more to protect people's privacy, be more transparent, be more accountable. If you look at our drone policy, we use drones to map crime scenes and accident scenes. It says right in the policy that there'll be no facial recognition built into that drone. So even if we're using the body cam, we have to remember why we're using it. It's to protect the public and protect the troopers. It's not for facial recognition or anything like that. It's a valid concern. I don't see us going there.
If we can, just one last question. Is the video admissible always in court? I mean, is this something that lawyers can rely on constantly, or are there cases where it wouldn't even be used, where the judge or the would have to look at it on a case-by-case basis?
I would treat it as any other piece of evidence where the rules of evidence would apply. They could say it's not admissible for certain legal reasons, no different than a seized weapon or seized drugs. The rules of evidence would stay the same. It's just another piece. When we have video from a use of force or any criminal arrest, we take it and we log it as evidence along with every other piece.
I think we talked a lot about body cameras and dash cameras. Thank you for answering all my questions. That was a wonderful discussion. And Trooper Grant, you have been wonderful. You've been waiting here as we finished our discussion. And I know that you came in specifically because what prompted our asking you to come in was when Trooper Weirden was here last time. And as he was walking out, we were talking a little bit about recruitment. And he said, we are doing some nice, exciting things that we wasn't done years ago. And we're trying to get this word out to the public about the recruitment for the state police force. And that is one of the reasons why we wanted to have you come in. So what is it that you are doing that's new and exciting?
Yes, absolutely. You find out over the years, law enforcement, you have to evolve. You know, you have to reflect with what your community is. You need to reflect what your potential candidates are. What are they doing? Where are they? So we have found over the past year and a half or so that our potential candidates, they're on social media. And we were never really heavy, or I shouldn't say never really, we weren't on social media recruiting before. So over the past year, we've really hit social media hard. And we've been recruiting via social media. And not just that, we've been using social media to get out who we are, what we do, why you should become a trooper, but we've been using it to announce some of our events that we're holding. So at the beginning of this year, we held two pretty large events. One was a women in policing program where females and males, but in particular it was geared at women, could come in, they could hear 10 different female troopers in different areas of the state police talk about their life. What did they do before becoming a trooper? Why did they become a trooper? What do they do now? How did they find the training academy? So we did that. We had just over 100 women show for that. And then we did a general one, and we had about 300 people come in here, again, come in here, troopers, speak about what they do before, who are they, you know, what did you do to become a Connecticut State Trooper? And then both times we gave people the opportunity to just in a very informal, hang out in the lobby, hang out in the auditorium, and you can speak one-on-one with those troopers and maybe, you know, pick their brains a little more. And we did find that a lot of the people that left said, wow, I didn't know that I'm a nurse now. I didn't know I could become a trooper, or I'm an engineer, or I'm an accountant. So we kind of played off of that, and now we do trooper profiles on social media. And those trooper profiles show people, our future candidates, our future recruits, show them that these troopers are no different than you are. Some went to college. Some have a military background. Some were police officers before, some were accountants, nurses, engineers. So it allows our potential candidates to connect with the troopers that are out there now.
Just out of curiosity, what age range is thinking about becoming a trooper?
You'd be amazed. But first of all, you have to be at least 21. Our oldest is 60.
All right, there's hope for me. There we go.
Well, we find that, you know, some of these people, I'm going to say probably 40s and up. Obviously, this is going to be a second career for a lot of them. And a lot of them have said, this is what I've always wanted to do, but my parents wanted me to become an engineer or become a nurse or become a teacher, or my mother didn't want me to do it because the job was too dangerous and I was only 21. So now you're seeing some of our older candidates had a full career, and now this is their lifelong dream, and they're going to give it their best shot.
Just for the older generation, I mean, what are the odds of a 60-year-old becoming a state trooper?
I would say the hardest part would probably be the academy, because it is very physically and mentally demanding. And I don't know. I know about me. At the end of my workday, I want to go home and go to bed right away.
Yes,
so,
indeed.
But in the academy, you know, it's a full day. You're up at 5:15 in the morning, and you're not going to bed till 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and then you're getting up the next day. And these are full days. Not only are they mentally challenging because you are sitting in a classroom a lot of the time, but they're physically demanding.
You know, I'm thinking of Clint Eastwood and Tommy Lee Jones in Space Cowboys. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you're reaching for the Tylenol and and the hot water bottle and all the rest of those things. How many troopers are you looking for in terms of recruiting?
We're always looking for the best qualified, so whatever that number in the end turns out to be. I'm not sure. I don't know if Trooper Weirden would know any different, but I'm not sure that they have a set number. You know, obviously we do need a lot more troopers. We'd like to have a lot more troopers. We have a large number that can retire over the next few years, so we definitely want to replenish those ranks. But, I mean, anybody who feels that this is something, and it all starts with, it's a commitment to your community and it's a lifetime of service to others. So you have to like the public, you have to like people, you have to like talking to people, and you have to know that you are a public servant and that will be your entire career.
What made you get into the state police force?
So I wanted to be a nurse.
Oh, there we go.
And I went to college and, you know, those chemistries and those, yeah, they didn't work out so well. Mm-hmm. So what am I going to do?
Organic chemistry always gets everybody.
You can keep that. when I went to college, criminal justice as a major was not a thing yet. So I majored in sociology and took a couple criminal justice courses. And then, I mean, I was a police dispatcher and they were like, yeah, take the test. You'd be able to do this job. This is something, you know, you like talking to people and working with people. And so I became a police officer. And then as a police officer, I watched the state police major crime unit coming in to help us with our bigger investigations. And I was like, no, wait a minute. I want to do that job. I want to be state police major crime. So I applied to the state police and here I am. But it all started because I wanted to be a nurse and I couldn't get through chemistry. So.
And how has life turned out for you?
I cannot complain. It turned out very well. You know, obviously the state police has given me far more opportunities than when I was with a police department. But I mean, the police department is what gives you my foundation. That's where I got my start. Trooper Weirden was a local police officer also first. But it just depends on what you want to do with your career. And whenever I speak with potential candidates, that's what they say. You know, I can't decide between state police or local police. And I'm like, well, it depends on what it is you want to do with your law enforcement career. Because there are smaller police departments, there are city police departments that have more to offer. And then there's the state police, which has a huge variety. But again, it's what you want to do with your career.
Big push nowadays for more women and minorities to enter the state police force. And how is that working out?
Correct. We always want to, every law enforcement agency wants to reflect their community. So, yes, we are looking for more minorities. We are looking for women. One of the things that we do find is because the state police is so large and so spread out that we find a lot of women and minorities are staying with comfort. So it could be a town, it could be a city police department.
They're staying local.
Staying local.
Okay.
It's their comfort zone. And I was the same way. That's how I got my start.
Do you see that social media is helping you change that? Or has it made any difference?
Social media is definitely helping us change it because people are getting to see what it is exactly that we do. And a lot of people's perception of the state police before they come and get information from us is that you're just on the highway.
Mm-hmm.
So they see on social media that's while that's true, yes, we are on the highway. We are also in towns, and we do a lot of community type service work. So you will see us at Girl Scout events. You'll see us with the Boy Scouts. You'll see us, you know, at a community center. We were just at a senior center the other day. So you will see, they're starting to see now more that troopers are involved with a lot more than just state police. They are getting out into the community and speaking with others.
Trooper Weirden was saying the last time also that there has been a big push to get members of the LGBTQ community to get involved with the state police force. Are you finding recruits coming from that community?
We have a couple that come from that, but of course, you know, it's not that they walk up to you and tell you.
Exactly.
I mean, there may be more
but just getting the word out at least.
Yeah, I mean, the word is out there. We speak, like I said, we go anywhere and we go everywhere and we speak with every group, every community. First and foremost, because we want to tell you about ourselves. We love to brag. That's the first thing. But it's a great job. You know, I love it. I love what I do. I go to work every day and I enjoy it. I enjoy getting out into the community and speaking with anybody and everybody that wants to speak with me. So yeah, the more that we're out there, and we always encourage people, if you see that we're going to be someplace, and as long as it's a public venue, you see that we're going to be someplace, stop in and come talk to us. Mm-hmm. You never know. You know, we have spoken to so many people over the years that are like, well, you know, I didn't know anything about the state police, so I never applied. Well, come talk to us and find out about the state police and then decide if the state police is for you or not.
Trooper Weirden, you've been so good. You've been sitting here because I know that you're, but I have to ask you before you go. I have one minute left because I didn't ask you last time. I know that you were on the local force before you became a state trooper, but why did you decide that the state police was for you?
Actually, very similar to TFC Grant. I loved my job as a local officer. That's where I learned how to go to quals, how to talk to people, how to problem solve. And then I would see the state police show up to large-scale incidents and hear them talk about, we have a dive team, we have this, we have that. And I said, well, okay, maybe those are some things I'd like to do in my career. So that's when I decided to make the jump. The same thing. There's a lot more opportunity to do some very unique things. You want to work in cyber crimes. You want to work in recruiting. You want to work on governor security. There are very unique opportunities that only the state police will offer.
And Trooper Grant, with the 30, 45 seconds that we have left, if someone wants more information on how to find out about recruiting, how could they do that?
So the best way to go about that is to go to our website, and it's BBEA Connecticut Trooper. All that spelled out, nice and simple. You're laughing. See? Piece
it's
of
perfect,
cake, right?
Perfect.
So BAConnecticutTrooper.com, and our website contains all the information, but there's also a way to contact us. So if you have any more questions, you can certainly send us an email or you can give us a phone call.
TFC Grant, Trooper First Class Kelly Grant, thank you. I appreciate you coming in. Thank you for your time. It was wonderful meeting you after watching you on TV for many years. Yeah. And Trooper Tyler Weirden, member of the State Police Governor's Security Unit. Trooper Weirden, always a pleasure. Thanks for coming in again.
Thanks, Ron.
If you want to join in the conversation, you can email us, tfs@wshu.org. On Facebook, find us at Full Story WSHU. And if you enjoyed the program and if you want to download it, it is available as a podcast. That's it for our show today. Joel Sears, our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Fatou Sangari, Sabrina Garone, Roberto Rojas. J.D. Allen is the producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of the Full Story.